Support for WMNF comes from our members in the Straz Center for the Performing Arts, presenting A Jew Grows in Brooklyn, a comedy musical about the search for identity and meaning. A Jew Grows in Brooklyn is Friday, March 2nd and Saturday, March 3rd at 8 p.m. More at strazcenter.org or 813-229-STAR. I'm Duncan Strauss, really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll speak with Dr. Walter Burkhardt Jr. about canine post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, in military dogs. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Portugal the Man with, not coincidentally, Guns and Dogs here on Talking Animals. That's Portugal the Man with Guns and Dogs. Fairly relevant animal song of sorts leads us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Dr. Walter Burkhardt Jr., a veterinarian and chief of behavioral medicine at the Daniel E. Holland Military Working Dog Hospital at Lackland Air Force Base. Dr. Burkhardt is considered the leading authority on canine post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which is believed to be increasingly seen now in military dogs. We'll hear about canine PTSD, identified only relatively recently as an affliction in dogs, and the work Dr. Burkhardt does with those dogs and other vets, helping them diagnose and treat those dogs, and more when we speak to Dr. Burkhardt Jr. in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to the Renaissance Festival in Tampa, which started last weekend and continues each weekend through April. And we'll hear another animal song or two, including a great new tune from Shearwater. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment, a look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item actually concerns the Talking Animals camp, by which I refer to the Talking Animals Music Night, featuring 11 great bands from the Tampa Bay area performing animal songs. It's going to be held March 31st at New World Brewery, featuring a pretty cool, musically diverse slate of bands, including, get this, Sons of Hippies, Johnny Cakes and the Four Horsemen and the Apocalypso, Rebecca Pulley and Rob Pastore, Ricky Wilcox and the Moonsnakes, Sunset Bridge, Talk to Mark featuring Scott Elliott, yeah, WNF's own, host of the All Souls edition of It's the Music, coming up right after this show, as it does every Wednesday, Loris Vidal, Tribal Style, Acme Jazz Garage, The Happiness Machine, terrific new band that rose out of the ashes of the Sun Society, and Rayzilla's PBS, featuring Ray Villadonga, one of the hosts of Step Outside, every Wednesday night from 10 p.m. to midnight right here on WMNF. So, pretty cool lineup. And whatever their style or genre, again, all these bands will be playing animal songs. So it's going to be a lot of fun. You don't want to miss it. Tickets will be a modest $8 in advance, $10 at the door, and this benefit for WMNF. You can go to WMNF.org for tickets or other info, or call here at the station, 813-238-8001, and speak with Miss Julie about tickets or other details. Look forward to seeing you there. On to the news. The Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus will be allowed to use bull hooks on elephants during its performances in Atlanta this week, despite a countywide ban on the devices. Bull hooks are tools with long handles and a sharp hook at one end that allows trainers to apply varying degrees of pressure to sensitive spots on an elephant's body. Circuses say the tools are necessary for the safe handling of elephants, but critics say bull hooks are harmful to the animals. In June, Fulton County commissioners voted for a ban on the controversial devices, becoming the first Georgia jurisdiction to do so. But last week, a Fulton County Superior Court judge issued an order that temporarily overrode the ban. In his order, Fulton County Superior Court Judge John Goger said the city of Atlanta had not adopted an elephant ordinance of its own. He also said there is no intergovernmental agreement between the county and the city for animal control services, which enforces the ban. However, Fulton County Commissioner Rob Pitts says the city has been paying for and using those county services. Quote, it says to me, even in the absence of a signed document, there is an implied agreement, and therefore we have the right to enforce this provision in the city of Atlanta, he told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Pitts says he supports the bull hook ban because he believes the tools are harmful to elephants. Moving internationally for a moment, Dateline Beijing. A rights group says animal welfare is becoming an increasingly trendy concern among ordinary Chinese as celebrities like basketball star Yao Ming speak out against shark fin soup and bear bile tonics. The founder of the Hong Kong-based Animals Asia Foundation, Jill Robinson, said Tuesday that she's seen interest in animal rights snowball in China over the last few years, spurred by support from celebrity activists like Yao and shifting attitudes among young people. Robinson spoke at an event in Beijing calling for an end to bear bile farming, the practice of extracting bile from the gallbladders of living bears. Yao threw his support behind the cause last week by visiting one of the group's bear sanctuaries. And of course, Jewel Robinson was a guest on Talking Animals September 28th, I think it was, a few days before our friends at Florida Voices for Animals brought her in for a cool talk. So, anyways, glad to see she continues to see progress, as we discussed here on this show. Locally, some things coming up that I want to let you know about, including the Neuterathon. That's right, 2 days. Very, very reasonably priced. Again, we're not allowed to say the price on the air here at WNF of events other than our own. But Saturday, February 25th, and Sunday, February 26th, there is a plan to neuter upwards of 500 male cats. And thanks to Animal Coalition of Tampa, Not surprising, perhaps, an appointment is required, so you need to call 813-250-1234. But again, if you have a male cat that hasn't been neutered, you think, gosh, we really got to get to it, but it's a little tough to fit into the budget right now, this is the time for you. So more information can also be had at actampa.org. On a related note, but in a different area, on Sunday, February 26th, yes, PCA Tampa Bay has a Fix a Feral Cat Day. So they'll be offering spay or neuter, various other services. And you can go to spcafl.org to find out more about how that works and how you can get your animal fixed. Especially if you got a feral colony or a cat nearby. And let's see, what else is coming up? Boy, two things. I was sort of struck by this when I realized that at first I thought I had the information wrong. But coming up on March 10th, there is the 25th annual Bark in the Park from 8:30 to noon at Al Lopez Park. And that, of course, involves a 1 mile walk, but vendors and activities for pets and the family and music and food and all kinds of stuff. And again, more information on that can be had at humanesocietytampa.org. But also, on March 10th, is the Tampa Bay Pet Expo at the Florida State Fairgrounds from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. So, again, exhibitors and information and obviously adoption. And Shorty Rossi, star of the hit series Pit Boss on Animal Planet, is the official spokesperson and featured guest. So you can find out more about that at TampaBayPetExpo.com. And we're on a roll here, so why not keep going? Looking down the road a little bit further, Friends of Strays annual luncheon will be on Saturday, March 17th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Hilton St. Petersburg Bayfront in downtown St. Petersburg. Portion of the proceeds will benefit the Friends of Strays programs and services for homeless animals. Alicia Perez, television personality and animal advocate, is the master of ceremonies. There'll be a silent auction, three-course meal, cash bar, fashion show, and more. So space is limited. They are looking for RSVPs, and you can do that or find out more by calling Friends of Strays at 727-522-6566 or just simply go to their website, friendsofstrays.com. And along those lines, and on that that same day, but conceivably you could do both. And this, I'm referring to the 20th annual Mutt Strut. It's Saturday, March 17th, Eagle Lake Park in Largo from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And involves vendors, wag bags, adoptable pets, food vendors, contest games, demonstrations, and so again, the same event they've been doing for obviously the 20th year now, but a new location. You can find out more. Want to get involved in any capacity by going to humanesocietyofpinellas.org or calling 727-797-7722. And if you think you got a naughty pet, naughty dog, Camp Bow Wow, the Pet Care Franchise has announced the launch of its Bad to the Bone contest, a nationwide hunt for the worst-behaved dog in North America. So whether the owners are at work in another room or even present, some of the cutest pooches can have the worst manners. And as such, Camp Bow Wow is seeking to fix badly behaved dogs across the country and turn them into perfect pups. From chewing your shoes and eating the mail to bathroom mishaps on the white rug, no crime is too big or small. So taking submissions up through May 18th, and then they will determine the 51 bad dog finalists and ultimately announce the grand prize winner, who will receive a full year of services at either a Camp Bow Wow or Home Buddies of his or her choice, and will receive training from a Bow Wow Behavior Buddies certified trainer to fix this pup's naughty behavior. So to find out more, see the list of entries, or get involved, you can go to their Facebook page, facebook.com/campbowwow. All right, let's. We got more news that we will, I'm sure, probably come back to later in the show. But right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Kevin Hart with part of a piece called Phobias on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I don't like dolphins. I'm scared of dolphins. I am. Me and my wife, we was in Maui, right? We were in Maui. She's like, come on, babe. We should go swim with the dolphins. I was like, nah. I told you how I feel about them dolphins. She's like, come on, stop being a bitch. Let's just do it. I was like, don't call me no bitch. She's like, bitch? Man, whatever. Like, you know, we don't got to come back, so you just got to, she's stupid. That's all I had. I didn't have nothing else to say. So we go, we get there. They got the dolphins in this tank. It's like 8 dolphins in this tank, right? When I get there, I see this old lady on the back of a dolphin. I see this little boy. I'm like, you know what, babe? I might have been overreacting. Get the camera, take some pictures of me on the back of the dolphin. I was hyped, right? I get in the water. I'm on the back of the dolphin. The instructor, he's like, as soon as you grab the dolphin fin, the dolphin's going to start taking you around. So whenever you're ready, grab his fin. I was like, all right, cool. I'm ready. As soon as I grabbed my dolphin fin, my dolphin went straight to the bottom of the tank. Like, he just went down. So because I was scared, I didn't let go. I held on. Like, you know when you're scared, how you start to mentally create in your own mind? I was like, okay, it's obvious that I got a racist dolphin. He don't like black people. He done cut a tail with a shark, bring him a black piece of meat. Something bad about to happen, right? So I let go. I get to the top. When I let go, I'm so scared, I start snapping on the instructor as soon as I see him. I was like, nobody saw dolphin number 8 missing? Huh? Y'all didn't notice I was going for like 30 seconds? He tried to kill me! He tried to kill me! I was mad. I was fucking scared. I was like, y'all see the old lady and a little boy, but nobody saw the black swirl missing? Huh? Nobody noticed that the black dot wasn't going around? Y'all didn't notice that? He's like, calm down, man. Calm down. It's 3 feet. Just stand up. I was like, what? What'd he say? I didn't even realize that I was walking and talking shit. At the same time. Come to find out, I never even went underwater. What happened was, some water splashed in my face. And I panicked. I made it up. I made it all up. I was scared.
All right, that was Kevin Hart with a part of a piece called Phobias, taken from his album. I'm a grown little man. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. And we'll be back hopefully momentarily with Dr. Burkhart. It's Talking Animals. I'm WMNF. All right. We have Dr. Burkhart. We're lucky to find him. He's a busy day, full meetings and stuff. So Dr. Burkhart, welcome to Talking Animals. Thanks so much for making the time to join us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So let's maybe trim away some of the preamble and other things I might have started with, and just maybe you could just sort of describe the Daniel E. Holland Military Working Dog Hospital and you know, just maybe paint us a little picture of what it looks like and what goes on there.
Well, our hospital is in essence the central hospital for military working dogs that work for the U.S. government, and it's about a 38,000 square foot facility. It's a quite large facility. We have over a dozen docs here, most of which are specialists, and about 30 or 40 techs, technicians, and support staff. So it's a large referral level hospital that supports military working dogs.
Okay, and one of the ways your duties are described is that you're responsible for the behavioral care of over, 1,500 military working dogs around the world. So does that mean that a number of dogs end up at the hospital there, or does that mean you're also traveling constantly to also help attend to the needs of those dogs?
Well, a little bit of both of those and something a little bit more, too. As it happens, most of the dogs that are here at Lackland Air Force Base are here either because they are in training or because they are here to train human students to handle military working dogs. The majority of operational dogs are located at one of about 200 locations around the world. So on occasion, I do travel to evaluate and work with specific military working dogs, but through the wonders of modern technology, a lot of the assessment and even the treatment evaluation that I can do these days, we do via telemedicine, basically digital videos and consultations with attending veterinarians at one of those 200 sites, because we have veterinarians, Army veterinarians, at each of those sites who can be my eyes and ears and obviously the treatment portion of our program as well.
Wow, that sounds ambitious and busy. How many dogs are currently in combat that are sort of under your broad purview, as you've just described it?
I don't have a hard and fast number for that. I'm told that there are about 600 dogs that are deployed at any one time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And all right, so in the course of that work and traveling around or doing the telemedicine as you described, I mean, when did you first start to see what I guess ultimately, if not right away, you defined as canine PTSD?
Well, the problem started rearing its head about 2007, where I was starting to see a small cluster of cases that sort of sounded vaguely familiar. Matter of fact, one or two times I said, haven't we already talked about this dog? And no, it was in fact another animal. And I started at that point, along with my colleagues, to say, are we starting to see something here that's a trend? Because it's a little bit different from the type of problems that we were experiencing in working dogs before that. Parenthetically, military working dogs have all sorts of behavior problems, or can have all sorts of behavior problems, much like pet dogs. But this was just something that was somewhat different. So 2007, some anecdotal reports. In the last year or so, we've really tried to start defining this as a problem that we can then have as a better identification by my attending veterinarians, as well as by the dog handlers themselves and their kennel masters.
And Dr. Burkhardt, I mean, one of the things we'll maybe touch on in a moment is because it sounds like there's more than a little disagreement amongst at least some of your colleagues about this notion, about the I guess even existence, if not diagnosis, of canine PTSD. But I'd be curious to know, along those lines, when you were first seeing those clusters and starting to wonder what was going on. You know, when someone first started, maybe it was you, but when someone first started to raise this possibility, hey, maybe this is a canine version of the PTSD we're seeing in our soldiers. I mean, what was the initial response to that initial kind of idea being floated?
Well, actually, the idea, I won't take credit for it because I didn't float the term.
Yeah.
And I was actually resistant to it because I thought that it was, in some ways, it could be problematic for us to use a term that's so similar to a condition in people because we really didn't know. And I'm a data kind of guy. So the big fancy word is epidemiology. Epidemiologists tell us that you need to collect data before you call something something.
Right.
And so that's kind of the skepticism that I had, and I'm sure a lot of other people would have the same type of skepticism. However, when we created the term canine PTSD, we did so in a fairly well-defined way as a manner, a shorthand, if you will, so that in fact our veterinarians and operational people could identify dogs that were affected.
Hmm.
And the dogs do have, you know, some similarities from case to case.
And so now, because if this sort of began in 2007, so now we're, I guess, the better part of 5 years in, what are the sort of key beliefs or contentions on the side of those who still don't seem to embrace the idea that canine PTSD, you know, exists or is even a valid diagnosis? What do they think's going on, if not that?
Well, you know, I know a lot of most of my colleagues in private practice don't use the diagnosis of PTSD at all, and for us, we've defined it narrowly to refer to combat settings. So it's not like in people where it could refer to natural disasters, physical or sexual abuse, threat of injury, and stuff like that. It really involves combat settings only,
mm-hmm.
And I don't know any of my behavior specialist colleagues that would say, you know, gee whiz, you know, dogs don't get overly reactive to loud noises, and they don't show performance failure when put under certain types of distress. So I don't think there's a lot of resistance in that realm. I think probably most of the resistance is the kind of resistance that I would give you, which is, you know, I don't know that this is the same thing as post-traumatic stress disorder in people, so I'm not sure that that's the right term to use for it in some ways. However, there are enough commonalities in the signs that shorthand is not a bad thing to use.
Sure, sure. Just, I guess it gets everybody quickly talking about the same sort of thing when they're...
You know, it's like the disease formerly known as Alzheimer's disease, to kind of be a little bit facetious.
Mm-hmm.
When you... let's say Asperger's syndrome. When you say those terms, you can draw a quick mental picture of the types of behavioral signs that you might expect to see in a patient that has that type of a problem.
Sure. Well,
so that's in some ways that's the way that we're using the terminology with dogs.
I got you. And so, Dr. Burkhart, then so you earlier in our conversation said there's probably at any given time maybe 600 military dogs deployed. What percentage of those are now exhibiting the signs of what, for those shorthand purposes, you are calling canine PTSD?
Well, we believe that at least 5% of the dogs that are getting deployed are having signs that are compatible with canine PTSD. So that means in a year we're very likely to see 30 or so cases, and that's, keep in mind, only one of the types of behavior problems that could cause performance failure in military dogs. That being said, that's a pretty significant chunk.
Sure. And is there, Dr. Burkhart, a sort of continuum of symptoms exhibited by these sorts of dogs? And what are some of those symptoms that you've now identified with this?
Well, absolutely. You know, dogs do show a spectrum. I'm going to split hairs, not to split hairs, but to be real clear here. When we talk about behavior problems in dogs and in animals in general, we really focus on signs, which are observable behaviors, since dogs really can't tell us what's going on inside. So
sure.
There aren't symptoms. There aren't verbal reports of internal states. That's
okay.
A symptom.
Okay.
Like I have a stomach ache.
Okay.
So what are those clinical signs that we see in dogs? They include things like overreactivity to noise or other events in the environment that may go along with hypervigilance, dogs that are continually scanning the environment. Secondly, we do see dogs that will actively work to escape or avoid particular situations or settings. Oftentimes, these are work-related or related to situations of combat where these signs started to occur. Thirdly, we may see changes in the social relationship, or as the dog handlers use the term rapport, R-A-P-P-O-R-T,
mm-hmm.
The way they get along with each other. So a dog that worked relatively independently may now be really sticking to the handler like glue, or a dog that was pretty strongly affiliated with the handler may act aloof or perhaps even aggressive. And the sign that seems to tie most of these cases together, not that all of the cases will show all of the signs, but the one that seems to tie them together is that the dogs are showing performance failure. And since most of what our dogs are doing right now in terms of saving human lives are looking for explosives, that means that they're either inaccurately saying that there's an explosive present or they're missing explosives when there are in fact explosives there. And it could be a real obvious thing that they're just not using their nose to work, or it could be that they look like they're working, but they're not showing the accuracy that they had shown previous to showing these signs of canine PTSD.
Wow. Okay. I'm Duncan Schatz. This is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is a veterinarian, Dr. Walter Burkhardt Jr., chief of behavioral medicine at the Daniel E. Holland Military Working Dog Hospital at Lackland Air Force Base. Invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing DJ at WMNF.org. So Dr. Burkhardt, I guess the answer is pretty serious, but what are the implications then of a dog who is afflicted with the PTSD, obviously particularly a dog, you know, in combat and maybe assigned to that kind of task you just described?
Well, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. First is from the dog's point of view, certainly these dogs obviously are showing signs of distress, both physiological as well as behavioral signs of distress. Just their body postures, their heart rate and respiration show us that they are distressed. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that, and this is where there is a similarity with human PTSD, these signs don't go away. So they're something that just doesn't spontaneously cure itself, if you will. Rather, it's something that's going to require some intervention, or that the dog is going to be lost to service. So the dogs that are most severely affected are no longer going to be able to work. And so, That's for them the biggest part of the problem. I've made this point before, and I think it's really important to make, that this is a problem for dogs, and it's a problem that's going to make at least half of the dogs that are affected leave our service, either through adoption or transfer to a job where they don't have to be in that type of environment. But it's also a human health problem.
Sure.
Because these dogs work intimately with human teams, and if the dog is either not doing its job and misses something, not only can the dog get hurt, but people can get killed.
Sure.
And if the dog is just absolutely distressed and freezing and isn't working operationally, you could see how that dog's handler now has the responsibility not only to care for themselves and their colleagues, but also take care of a dog that's having problems. So it's both a dog concern and it's as well as a human health concern. So it's significant enough that I think it really is something that warrants quick identification. And if we can treat it.
And so that, I guess, the next question then would be what kind of treatment then is called for in those situations?
You know, initially the first aid for a dog showing severe signs of what we're calling canine PTSD is to get them out of the fray.
Mm-hmm.
So you get them out of harm's way, and at that point you do some of the things that parallel what we do for people PTSD as well. We do environmental enrichment. We do some play with them. We will have the handlers work with them on their substance detection or their explosive detection tasks, but not in a situation that's combat related. So we maintain the relationship between the dog and the handler. We maintain the skills. Sometimes we need to use some medications. You know, in a situation where a human might be in a car accident and isn't severely injured, but really gets shaken up, and 6 hours later they still got that tremor in their hands and their heart rate's up and they're kind of breathing fast and their skin's cold and clammy, the attending physician may in fact be considering using an anti-anxiety medication, and sometimes we'll use those for short-term use in dogs as well. Later on, the best treatment that we can do with the dogs that are severely affected is, if they don't respond immediately, is get them back out of harm's way and do some what we call desensitization and counterconditioning. It's a method of trying to reintroduce them to that environment while reinforcing the behaviors that we need to see and not reinforcing the problem behaviors.
Sure.
And so that's also what's done in people.
Yeah.
With PTSD, and it's really the most successful treatment regime.
And it also sounds like, Dr. Burkhardt, that the key thing to you know, determining what kind of treatment may or may not be effective and then trying to treat that dog is that the handler that dog has been with, you know, in that combat situation where maybe something did start to suggest there was something amiss with the dog, that when that dog is pulled out, the handler comes with it either to Lackland or, you know, wherever they might be. Is that, so they continue to be a team, whatever's going on. Is that right? Is that part of like the better chance for a treatment to be effective?
Yeah, and that's a good point. Both in terms of the treatment, it is always optimal to have the handler that's been working with the dog continue to work with the dog if that's possible. Because that's the most familiar setting for the dog and for the handler, and keeping them in a familiar location is also important.
Sure.
And thirdly, keeping them in a location where they can actually do realistic training. So for the most part, doggies don't come here with their handlers to Lackland. Rather, they're going to be at their normal training installations so they can do the type of work that they need to be doing. That's pretty important.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like that would be a key factor in how much success there would be kind of resharpening that dog's skills and having everybody feel comfortable sending that dog and the handler back into combat.
You bet. You know, and it's going to be the handler and the kennel master of that kennel and the unit commander that's really going to make the assessment. Do we want to, you know, risk putting this dog back into harm's way? Even if they're doing really, really well on a treatment plan, sometimes, you know, it's really some very practical decisions on whether the dog's going to be sent back in harm's way. We've had at least a few that have, you know, really had bad problems. They've gone through some really intensive work back home, and they've gone back into service, and knock wood, so far, they seem to be doing pretty well.
Oh, good. So, Dr. Brookhart, do you have a couple more minutes? I have a couple more questions I'd love to ask, and I'd like to get at least one or two of the many callers that I know have been interested in hearing this, but also speaking with you. Do you have a few more minutes that we could
do? Yeah, please, go ahead.
Okay, great. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Brookhart.
Hi, this is Shirley Patterson.
Hi, Shirley, did you have a quick question for Dr. Brookhart?
Well, just a quick story. A few years back, we picked up a dog out of the Ocala National Forest.
Okay.
Skin and bones. Pit, and we brought him home and rehabbed him, and everything seemed fine, as much as you can. And somebody brought him a soup bone. It was raw meat.
Mm-hmm.
Tossed it to him out in the yard, and he changed his personality in a flash. It was like he was back in the woods fighting for his food. We had to just leave him alone until he had consumed his bone. And of course, nobody ever brought him anything like that later, but it was scary.
And you never saw that same kind of behavior again, I take it.
No. Well, nobody gave him anything raw. We just had a strict rule about it.
Sure.
Anything for him to eat had to go by us first, because we didn't want that to happen. But all I could figure was it was a flashback, you know.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks for your call, Dr. Brookhart. Do you have any response to that?
You know, that's one of the things that's probably most difficult in working with behavior in animals in general. Is it's really, really, really difficult to infer sometimes what's motivating the behavior and why it turns on, why it turns off.
Mm-hmm.
That's a challenge that we have. You know, if that were Uncle Fred, you know, you could go, Uncle Fred, why are you doing that? And
yeah,
they could in some ways give us a little bit of an idea of why they're doing what they're doing. But you know, sometimes we make up fairy tales for why dogs do stuff.
Sure.
And, you know, the shy dog, you know, must have been beaten as a puppy. And if we really didn't see that dog as a puppy, we really don't have any idea whether that was part and parcel of the way God made them. That's their temperament. Or alternatively, maybe they really did have some bad experiences. Sometimes that's really difficult to sort out.
Sure. So Dr. Brookhart, in the wake of sort of this awareness of the canine PTSD in the last, you know, better part of 5 years, what adjustments have been made to the way the military dogs are deployed? I mean, are there altering the length of tour of duties or what they're asked to do, or some change in their training so as to, you know, maybe try to mitigate this preemptively? Or
yeah, I think the three biggest things that have happened, and this is really over the last 3 to 4 years. Number one is, both for the people as well as for the dogs, the military is striving for much more realistic training prior to the to anybody going into combat,
mm-hmm.
so that, that we can find, at very worst, we can find dogs that are going to break and potentially even people that are going to break before they get into harm's way and maybe not even send them out.
Sure.
But alternatively, for dogs that are maybe susceptible to having problems, but, you know, some training, some pre-training will help avoid those. I think that's been a really big step. Step number two is we are actively working to identify dogs that are having problems before the before it gets really, really bad. In some ways, our dog handlers and even our veterinarians and veterinary technicians had not had a great degree of training in identifying behavioral problems. Training issues, yeah, behavioral problems, not as much. So we're trying to increase that level of awareness. And then the third thing is really trying to get into evaluation and treatment as quickly as possible. So, you know, we have very, very scant amounts of information, and we have virtually no good research yet on the problem and treating the problem. But anecdote tells us that the earlier we intervene, the more likely it is that we're going to get some positive effects.
Sure. And as a data guy, you must be itching to get something that's a little more solid, but it sounds like anecdotally you're already well on your way.
Yeah, you know, we're working to collect some data, and we're right now working very, very hard to try to identify ways to capture better, more and better data on these dogs as time goes on, but it is kind of frustrating until we get a little bit more data to try to identify where we're headed.
Sure. Well, we just have about 1 minute or so left, but hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Burkhard. A quick question.
Hello.
For Dr. Burkhard. Hi. Hi, do you
Hello?
Have a quick question or comment for Dr. Burkhard?
Oh, yes. Hi.
Hi.
My son is in the military, and he actually is a canine specialist for the Navy. He's had 4 dogs. The first one showed the signs of exactly what you're talking about. It was a Belgian Malinois, and they had to retire the dog. He's been training people now. He's a trainer of dog trainers. And I do believe he does know a little bit about behavioral training as opposed to just the conditioning kind of training. But I can tell you this, it's very real, it's very serious. And he was very sad to lose his first dog, but came back, and it showed all the signs you're speaking of.
Yeah, you know,
thanks for your call.
Without exception, I see that our handlers and trainers and kennel masters are highly motivated people, and they are extremely caring about their animals. And have had opportunity to talk at length with a number of the folks, yeah, it does. I mean, it really breaks them up when they lose a dog, and they are really gaining expertise quickly in trying to help deal with this, because they're our hands-on. They are our treatment plan for working with these dogs. It's not something that a veterinarian's doing. It's something that the handler's doing for the most part.
Sure. Just reporting that on the site experience probably helps you, again, with that anecdotal.
Yeah, and doing the behavioral management, trying to get the dog comfortable in those settings. It's the handler that's really, really responsible for doing that.
Sure. Well, Dr. Burkhard, I think we are sort of now at the end of our time, but gosh, I really, really appreciate you making the time to speak with us today on Talking Animals. It's a fascinating topic, and also it's very encouraging, it sounds like, that things are getting better and better for these dogs to have fewer and fewer incidents of the canine PTSD.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, and if we can keep this awareness up of how valuable these dogs are and what they're doing for us, that's a good thing.
Absolutely, and maybe somewhere down the road we'll talk again and get a little bit of update on just how those things seem to be looking at that point. So thank you again for your time and all your great work.
All right, thanks, and goodbye now.
Bye-bye. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. There'll be a prize, a pair of tickets to the Renaissance Festival in Tampa, which started last weekend and continues each weekend through April 1st, to the first person that calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune. It's Name That Animal Tune. I'm Talking Animals. All right, maybe we'll take that off the air, but we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, February 29th. Hope you'll join me then. Also, hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page or Twitter feed and more. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby Busalis. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott, the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. This is new music from Shearwater with a song called Animal Life. Taking us up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa. Thanks for listening. See you next Wednesday, 11 a.m., Talking Animals.
Born inside the gates of the family, hardened by a Roman machinery, cast among the building sites, the coiling wires, the shots collected, called out in the wake of a ladder held inside the family gathering, mirrored beams and dog-like stretch, the wandering association murmurs in the dark confessional, and rides along the road ephemeral as an animal. Pacing down the balance beam of half a remembered holidays. No rush of light, no sign of belonging, no joy in building love in the finishing. Chasing down an anodyne and half a reflected radiance to hide below the ancient barricade. In chambers like the rooms of swallow made.
President Obama proposes cutting the top tax rate for corporations from 35% to 28%. He suggests paying for it by eliminating dozens of tax loopholes companies already use to lower their rates. His attempt to overhaul the tax code may not lead to legislative action in a deeply divided Congress this election year, but it is likely to at least